The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Lung Cancer Diagnosis and Treatment is presented by Dr. Kevin Hubbard.
Good afternoon, everybody. Oh, yeah, boy, we're energetic, aren't we? We're starting to feel that convention right on the hind parts. I know, I can understand. And it's been a busy day, so I'm going to try to do what I can to make this as informative a presentation as I can and to try to involve you as much as I can in the process. I do understand the dangers of lecturing after lunch and the alkaline tide wafts in and crashes on the shores of the reticular activating system, and there's somnolence. Now, remember, I'm used to lecturing to medical students. I don't mind if you fall asleep, but let's be respectful and let's try not to snore so loudly that we wake the person sleeping next to us, okay? Let's just try to keep awake, see what we can do. It is a great privilege always to come before my college, the American College of Osteopathic Internists, but this is a real treat for me because I'm also standing in front of my colleagues in the College of Osteopathic Surgeons. My father was an osteopathic general surgeon and trained students and interns and residents for many years, and that's the specialty college that was very near and dear to his heart. So the privilege of coming before two outstanding austere organizations to give any sort of presentation is a rare honor and privilege, and I assure you I have approached this very humbly and very gratefully, and so I appreciate all of you being here. It means a lot. So let's talk a little bit about lung cancer. First of all, the obligatory financial disclosure slide. I have nothing to disclose. There isn't anything in my presentation that is a real or perceived conflict of interest. I would suggest that any honoraria that I might ever earn in terms of giving a presentation, 100% of those honoraria go to feed hungry children. Mine. And we have a hungry grandson now who's 7.5 months old, and I have 87,462 pictures that I'd be happy to show you, each and every one of them, because we're so doggone proud of that kid. So let's talk about what we're going to try to do here in our time together. We've taken three things, and Annette has defined, I think, an outstanding and very timely theme of Goldilocks medicine for the ACOI side of this thing. And so in this presentation, while it's going to be a conversation about lung cancer, and it's going to be how surgeons and oncologists and radiation oncologists all work together, and how we can all work more collaboratively, I will talk a little bit at times about where Goldilocks kind of sits in this thing, but it's going to be sort of a lung cancer 101 type of presentation. So we want to talk, first of all, about major risk factors for the development of lung cancer. And I should point out as we get started that while there are two forms of lung cancer, small cell and non-small cell lung cancer, small cell lung cancer only occupies about 13 to 15% of the total number of lung cancers that are out there. So our conversation is going to be about non-small cell lung cancer, which is the lion's share of those. Secondly, we're going to describe the role of driver mutation status in treatment options, what's available to us, and how we can approach them. And lastly, we're going to talk about general treatment options for patients who have early stage cancers as well as metastatic cancers. And so my hope at the end of all of this is to better equip each of you with the ability to go out next week in your practice and to be able to take a little bit better care of these folks and how you go about doing that. So we'll be making some introduction comments, which I'm doing now, and we'll talk about risk factors, a little bit about diagnosis, and then we'll talk about treatment options, and then I'll have some concluding remarks at the end. Lung cancer is a major health problem in the United States and worldwide. If you look at the risk factors and the types of lung cancers that come out, every year the American Cancer Society publishes that little CA Cancer Journal for Clinicians. And lung cancer ranks at the top as the leading cause of cancer-related death for both men and women in this country. Now, the real challenge is that lung cancer is the second most common type of cancer in both men and women in terms of incidence, but it's the leading killer in terms of cancer-related death for both genders. Leading cancer diagnosis, 1.8 million cases per year, and cancer-related cause of death worldwide. So it's a major health problem. Now, there's some interesting demographics that go with this. If you were to go back to 1964 and you were to look at the Surgeon General's report, you would see that that's really the time where we started talking about the relationship between smoking and the incidence of lung cancer. Much of that data, by the way, came out of World War II, where military recruits who were sent overseas to fight in the war were given free packages of cigarettes. And so they became habituated while they were in the service, came back, and because of the increased incidence of smoking-related illnesses, lung cancer included, the VA health system literally had to grow exponentially to accommodate the needs of those people. So our early staging and our early clinical trials results that talk about care of patients with lung cancer really came out of that experience. And so as we moved into the 60s, appreciating the problem that this was going to cause, the Surgeon General's report issued that report. Now, at that time, about one-third of American adults smoked. There were somewhere between 150 and 180 million of us at the time. One-third of the population worked out to about 50 million smokers. If we were to fast forward to 2017 and look at the data now, we find that smoking is prevalent in about 18% of our population. So that sounds great. Gosh, it sounds like we've reduced the number of smokers by half. If you do a little bit of calculation, though, you're going to find out one very important thing. The population has increased to somewhere between 312 and 315 million people. If you do the math, you take 18% of that, roughly, you're going to come out with about 50 million smokers. And so the raw number of smokers that are out there hasn't changed in over 50 years. 50 years of sending the message that smoking causes cancer has been unsuccessful in terms of making an impact in terms of lowering that rate. And this is not a small number. We're talking 1,300 deaths per day from smoking-related illnesses in the United States, which of course means that we have to replace those smokers. So 1,300 people have to take up smoking each day to replace the 1,300 that we lost yesterday. But I think we've got pretty good data. If you will look at this CAT scan, I'm sure that even the casual observer from the back of the room can pick up the reality. And if you look at the upper right-hand corner there, you'll notice a pack of cigarettes in the breast pocket of this patient. You probably notice this unusual thing in kind of the lower center portion of the CAT scan. Smoking causes cancer. Now we have radiographic evidence that that's the case. So one picture's worth a thousand words. So smoking is certainly the number one cause, but there are other causes as well. Patients who have received radiation therapy, for example, for lymphomas, would be at an increased risk for having lung cancer as well. Those patients who are exposed to environmental toxins, and here we're thinking about people who are exposed to wood dust, or we're thinking about occupational exposure at work. Some of those people may be exposed to radon gas. We still see a little bit about radon gas. Radon, when it breaks down, forms alpha particles that only travel a few millimeters in air, but if you have inhaled it into your lungs, now you're essentially radiating the bronchial mucosa with low doses of alpha particles, and we've seen that there's an increased incidence of bronchogenic carcinoma in that setting. Some patients have pulmonary fibrosis, and that's a potential risk factor as well. Those patients who have HIV infection, because their immunity has been lowered, we're beginning to see more and more information about immunity and its role in dealing with non-small cell lung cancer. We'll talk more about that here in just a few minutes. So that's certainly a concern. There appear to be certain genetic factors. Now, the challenge is in separating out the genetic factors from some of the environmental factors. For example, if you grew up in a home full of smokers, how do you separate out your own smoking exposure from genetic factors? And so there are some challenges that are associated with that. Unfortunately, there's a slight increase of non-small cell lung cancer in people who ingest alcohol, and there appear to be some ill-defined roles for certain dietary factors as well. Much of this is not well sorted out yet, so it is a little bit of a challenge as we separate that out. I think probably most of us have had enough clinical experience to recognize that the thing that really gets patients through the door, gets your attention, and gets you thinking about the possibility of bronchogenic carcinoma is that chest x-ray that gets done for whatever reason. So the patient's going to go and have a pre-op chest x-ray because they're going to have a knee replacement, or they're going to have some other type of surgery. Perhaps they're going to be in a situation where they might have had a cough or a cold or a little bit of a flu-like sensation. Doc, what do you think about a chest x-ray? And that kind of gets the ball rolling. But it doesn't stop there. Most of the time when you're in a situation like this, when you see that there is a mass on a chest x-ray, it's going to prompt an additional need for more information. And so the CT scan usually gets done at that point as well. Now the CT scan can give us a little bit of an estimation of cancer probability. And then we get into that constant discussion, to pet or not to pet. So Goldilocks comes to visit us, and it's, do you pet too much? Do you pet too little? Do you pet too hot? Do you pet too cold? What is just right? Where does PET scanning fit into that? So we're going to take a look at this here momentarily. So CT imaging is the standard imaging modality for every case of suspected lung cancer. IV contrast is preferred, so if their kidneys can take it, IV contrast is really helpful to us because it allows us to help define mediastinal adenopathy and anatomy. It allows us to understand whether or not there's invasion from the primary tumor, and it also lets us look for potentially involved lymph nodes. So those things can be very helpful to us. But it's also nice to be able to determine where to go from there. And here's the challenge, and here's where Goldilocks also kind of comes in, because we talked a little bit about the PET scan, but also, who needs a biopsy and who doesn't need a biopsy? Well, there might be certain rules that we can follow. For example, if it's above a certain size, or if there's spiculation identified on the CT scan, if there's calcium in it, that's actually a good thing. Breast cancer, we know that calcium or microcalcifications is a bad thing, and we should consider that the risk goes up with that. But with lung cancer, it's just the opposite. Calcium is actually good. It indicates that there's an increased likelihood that it's going to be a benign process versus a malignant one. So things that factor in, the larger the mass, the greater the concern. Also, if we're following these things in serial and we're following along over a period of time, using tincture of time is kind of our indicator for when we might step in, a progressive increase in size over time is concerning for that as well. Do I see one lesion? Do I see multiple lesions? Is there a past history of fever? In other words, being good osteopathic physicians, we want to make sure we get as much history as we possibly can. This provides us some additional information, but we can also utilize certain risk calculators. And these slides are going to be available on the website. And so what I did was I went ahead and put the links to these things. And this will allow you the opportunity to utilize the Brock University Malignancy Risk Calculator. There is a statistical correlation between all of these things together, calculating age, the gender of the patient, any comorbidities, the size of the mass, all of those things, and it will be able to crunch out a number for you that will help you understand if your patient is at an increased risk for malignancy, in which case biopsying the patient sooner is probably a reasonable thing to do. Or if it's one of those things where you can utilize a little bit of time to monitor things, to consider other options or alternative diagnoses so that you don't have to just go charging off to the interventional radiologist who's got a needle in his hand to poke it in that patient's chest. You've got some time to think about it. So understanding risk stratification will hopefully help figure this out, and maybe we can get Goldilocks a little closer to her bowl of porridge and make her happy because we're biopsying the right people and we're monitoring the people in a very, very right and thoughtful way. So what about diagnosis? Now, I made a little mention about to pet or not to pet. You know, the challenge we've got is PET imaging is hot. It's cool. It's great. It lets us look at all sorts of things. Until you begin to look at a few pets, and until you begin to do a few consults for patients who have hot pets, where there's increased SUV, surface uptake value, on certain lesions, and gosh, what do we do about that? Is this cancer? Is an oncology consult indicated? Is a biopsy indicated? A PET scan is like a two-year-old. It's really good about telling you there's something going on, but it isn't really all that good in terms of telling you what it is. You don't know if your house is on fire or if your dog needs to go outside, but you've got this hot spot, so you have to look at it and thoughtfully consider what your approach might be. So it can help us reveal occult metastatic disease, and it certainly can reduce the number of unnecessary thoracotomies. One study that we looked that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine about 10 years ago looked at whether or not PET scanning preoperatively would reduce the need for unnecessary thoracotomies, and it did. So that was helpful, because if you have patients who have stage 4 disease, doing a thoracotomy is not going to be helpful to those patients. And so it makes sense that we might try to find a way to use this as a barometer. The challenge is that it didn't really affect overall survival. So we do have some potential help with this. Integrated PET with CT scanning can be helpful to us as well. So you get the PET scan, you get the CAT scan, the computer fuses the two within the computer itself. So now you get anatomy, which is what the CT scan provides, and you get physiology. Increased uptake, the greater the number, the more likely it is to be malignancy, and now you can see anatomically where it's located. So this can be helpful to you as well. So where would the cutoff be? Well, we typically think anything less than 2, we're probably going to be safe calling that benign. Anything 5 or above, some series and some experts, to be fair, would say 4 or above would be a concern. It's that 2 to 4, 2 to 4.5, and we've all been there. It's like, what do you do with that person? Because there is a statistically increased risk of malignancy, but it's still much lower than 50% as compared with 5 or above, where we think it's going to be about a 50-50 proposition at that particular point. So it's really a challenge to understand where to go with some of these things. So bottom line is, when you get all this information, now you can carefully consider biopsy of suspected lesions. I use it primarily to try to help me understand if a patient has a potentially resectable lesion. Could this patient theoretically, if everything goes well, be resected for cure? And I can use it as a screen to kind of help me understand and give all of us some perspective on whether or not that might be possible. And if anything out of the potential range of resection shows up, then it's time to biopsy so that we make sure that we're giving the right patient to the surgeon, and we're helping patients understand that they may have cancer that's metastatic in certain cases, and that it wouldn't be appropriate at this particular point to consider surgery. We're all just pretty much familiar with biopsy procedures, hopefully at this point, but just a brief review. We've got the ever-popular needle biopsy done in interventional radiology. Very helpful for peripheral lesions. And I'm amazed at what in these interventional radiologists can do. I mean, they can fish that needle through just about anything to get you a tissue diagnosis. So they can actually get into the hilum and the mediastinum as well. Bronchoscopy is another helpful tool, very helpful for central lesions. I have to admit, I'm kind of fortunate in that I work in a comprehensive cancer center for my clinical time, 2 weeks a month. And so we've got the advantage of endobronchial ultrasound, also known as EBUS. And so it's just kind of the opportunity to put an ultrasound probe and look specifically at adenopathy to determine whether or not that adenopathy could be benign or malignant. And we can selectively biopsy, do a transbronchial biopsy of questionable lesions, and get additional tissue and really help stage the patient preoperatively. It can be very, very helpful. It also allows an opportunity to evaluate some hilar and mediastinal masses. In fact, many series suggest that that ought to be our primary choice in that particular situation. We, of course, many of us in the room, if you're over the age of 50, you grew up with the approach of mediastinoscopy, and it is still used in many institutions where you don't have access to some of these other newer tools. Historically, it was the gold standard. It was what you sent your patients out to do. But it's increasingly been relegated to those second attempt operations. And so you couldn't get the diagnosis with the other diagnostic procedures that I'd recommended, but perhaps you can get there with a mediastinoscopy. And so videoscopic assisted or done with a mediastinoscope, either of those are very reasonable approaches. As far as diagnosis is concerned, it's no secret that we've been getting new and more innovative tools into our armamentarium in terms of approaching these patients, and we've got a whole bunch of these that kind of sound like word salad. So you've got things like EGFR, ALK, and PD-L1, and NCQA, and HEDIS, and all those crazy wild super flummox things. We're really seeing a lot of information that has come out over the last 10 or so years talking about driver mutation status. And so what I'd like to do is to talk to you a little bit about driver mutation status and a little bit about immune marker status next. So what do we mean when we talk about a driver mutation? It kind of sounds like driving Miss Daisy. You know, he's sitting up in the front and he's just doing what he wants to do. Well, in a sense, that's what driver mutations do. Driver mutations are responsible for creating a lot of the push towards tumorigenesis. So when we see this, it occurs in cancer cells with mutations in genes that code for proteins that are critical to cell growth and survival. They are typically not found in the normal cells, in the germline. They are found only in the tumor line. So if you've got something that's found only in the tumor line, you've got the makings for sort of that magic bullet. All of a sudden, Goldilocks porridge is beginning to taste a little better. It's kind of our little brown sugar that we're adding, because now we've got targets that we can use that theoretically would spare normal cells from the toxicity and direct most of their toxic effect on cancer cells. And so we're in a happier place with that. So this graphic on the right side of the slide, you'll see a bunch of circles at the top, and you see things like EGFR, the epidermal growth factor receptor, ALK, the anaplastic lymphoma kinase, ROS1, HER2, originally described in breast cancer cells, HER2 has been described in many other solid tumor cell lines as well, so something to look out for. MET, RET, FGFR, fibroblast growth factor receptor. Well, these are all kind of nice tongue-twistery names, but the bottom line is that what they do is they drive certain pathways within the cell that are responsible for cell growth, cell division, and proliferation. And so they're the machinery that makes that happen. And we've got pathways like the RAS pathway, RAF pathway, PI3 kinase, mTOR, all of these other pathways that can get geared up. And at the bottom of that graphic, the message is most important, because the end result of all this process is that we talk about cell proliferation, cellular responses to apoptosis, invasion and metastasis, and angiogenesis, four of the major tools that cancers use to do their job. Well, how important is that really? Well, interestingly enough, if you look at the French Cooperative Thoracic Intergroup trial, they looked at 26,000 patients in 28 centers in their collection in Europe. And the interesting numbers were they looked at specifically tumor markers. Now, these driver mutations. Now, what's interesting about this is that you could have tested for more than one driver mutation in a tumor specimen, so the number is going to equal a number greater than 26,000 here. But the message that they noticed was that if they looked, and when they did their analysis, they noted that their driver mutation was identified in about 50% of all of the tumor specimens that were submitted. So half of the patients that are out there, according to this study, have some driver mutation that's pushing this process forward. This is a tool that we can utilize to treat the malignancy with. So understanding that, it can certainly be helpful. So going forward and understanding what our options might be, take a little bit of a look at some of the patients that we basically see as we're treating non-small cell lung cancer. So first of all, we're going to take a look at candidates for resection. Again, we've made mention about small cell lung cancer. It's managed with chemotherapy and radiation therapy as appropriate for patients based on their stage and their type of presentation. Many of the cases of non-small cell lung cancer, particularly the early stage, are managed with multimodality therapy, and surgery tends to be the big dog on the block going ahead with this. There are certainly anatomic considerations, and we'd like to see patients with disease limited to one lung, the mediastinum uninvolved, and no distant metastases. That's the ideal candidate to undergo this procedure. But there are also medical considerations, because smoking is the leading cause of this, and because we know that smokers have additional health care concerns. So what's their pulmonary function going to be like? Do they have any other problems such as heart problems? How does their liver work? Are their kidneys functional? Is this a patient who we're going to take to surgery? Maybe that patient needs a short period of time on the ventilator, but will this patient come off the ventilator? So many times we are in a situation where patients who are anatomically resectable are not medically resectable. And so the challenge then becomes, what other options do we have? We've shown over the course of the last 30 years, and I think it's been the experience of most of us, that if we have patients who are those borderline candidates, if we can get them to just change their behaviors for a 3 or 4 week period of time, they're no longer borderline. They will be able to come in with numbers that would allow them to be resected. So those are certainly some things that we can do in the clinic and in the office to try to counsel patients to improve. So again, a stage one patient would be a patient who has no nodal involvement. Stage two is going to include the T1B patients and as well as patients with N1 disease. These are the bronchial nodes. And stage 3A, these are patients who have T1 or T2 lesions. These are still fairly small lesions. And then there's T3N1, kind of a pesky animal. And then the more advanced tumors, larger tumors or more proximal tumors that either have no lymph node involvement or don't have any involvement of lymph nodes outside of the bronchial lymph nodes, so their hilar and mediastinal nodes have been spared. So again, preoperative evaluation is essential. These patients all get pulmonary function studies so that we can understand how well they work. If you're looking for patients who are candidates for things, if you've got a pre-op FEV1 in excess of 2 liters, or it's above 80% of predicted, they're generally going to be able to tolerate a pneumonectomy without too many problems. If you have a patient who has a pre-op FEV1 of greater than 1.5 liters, those patients should be able to tolerate a lobectomy without complication. Pulmonary function study should also include a measure of DLCO. This is the diffusion capacity for carbon monoxide, so it checks the membrane. Retrospective studies have demonstrated that the actual DLCO, the percent of the predicted value, and the predicted post-op DLCO are going to be the most important indicators in terms of understanding what morbidity, mortality, and post-op complications are going to be in that patient group. And then additional testing. You could do ABGs, exercise tolerance tests, as indicated. Again, not every patient is going to need to undergo that, but you might have selected patients who would benefit from that sort of evaluation. Lobectomy is generally preferred in early stage non-small cell lung cancer over a more limited procedure for peripheral lesions if your goal is complete resection. The concerns have been that there might be residual disease or microscopic disease left behind. Pneumonectomy, most of those patients will have proximal tumors, and because of the nature and the extent of resection, it may be necessary to consider a sleeve resection in some of those patients. Many of the procedures we're seeing now, I'm amazed at what cardiothoracic surgeons are able to do with videoscopic-assisted thoracoscopic surgery. Some of these big resections that historically we had thought those patients were really going to need to have an open thoracotomy are now managed with VATS procedures. The benefit for the non-surgeons in the room is that those patients have a lower operative morbidity and they have faster recoveries, typically 30 to 50% faster than the open thoracotomy patients. When you look at the trials of adequacy in terms of open thoracotomy versus VATS, it does appear that there's equivalence, but the challenge is that most of these are single institution studies and small prospective trials. So it's not like we've got numbers of 40,000 people undergoing these types of procedures and we were able to see that one was inherently better than another. Part of the challenge in looking at the data, and so it may be worth considering going forward to consider that sort of clinical trial so that we can get a little bit better understanding of whether or not that's going to be effective. Well, if you have patients who are unable to go to surgery but still have potentially treatable cancers and potentially curable cancers, it might be reasonable to consider another form of therapy. And here's where our radiation oncology colleagues have stepped in with their approach known as SBRT, stereotactic body radiation therapy. It delivers focused, discrete radiation therapy in single or multiple large doses. And as you can see from this diagram, using multiple multiple convergent beams to try to accomplish the goal. Multiple series have looked at this and they've determined that there's a local control rate at greater than 90% and long-term survival rates that are very similar to surgery. And so for those patients who can undergo a surgical procedure, SBRT seems to be a very reasonable approach and a very viable option for them in terms of proceeding with their treatment. In terms of systemic therapy, until probably about 18, 19 years ago, we were rather reluctant to administer chemotherapy in early stage non-small cell lung cancer. But as trials matured and we began to develop a body of literature, there was a clear emerging consensus that utilizing a platinum doublet therapy, utilizing platinum plus an additional agent, and it became the standard of care for patients with stage 2 disease and selected patients who had stage 1B disease. Typically, the platinum doublet that most people preferred was cisplatin over carboplatin, who is kind of a kinder, gentler version of cisplatin. So most of us prefer to use cisplatin in that particular setting. In the non-squamous histology, we could add pemetrexed. In the squamous histology, the taxanes, Taxol and Taxotere, vinorelbine or gemcitabine are all reasonable considerations. As far as molecularly targeted therapies in early stage lung cancer, there's no clear-cut role for that currently. We'll talk a little bit more about what that looks like here in just a few minutes. As far as treatment of early stage non-small cell lung cancer, then it would appear that surgery with lobectomy, hopefully, or SBRT would be an option. Patients with stage 2 disease and some 1B patients are going to receive adjuvant systemic therapy for 4 cycles. And when possible, we always encourage patients to participate in clinical trials. So for patients who have the more advanced non-small cell lung cancer, stage 3 disease, this is a particularly pesky area because these patients have a high rate of recurrence. Some of them are resectable, many are not, and the role of multimodality therapy is really paramount in this particular group of patients. The new staging system is coming out, the 8th edition. It's going to be utilized after the first of the year. So if you didn't think it was confusing with current staging, or you might have wondered why he was really not spending a whole lot of time on staging, it's because after the first of the year, when we all get home, get settled, and get through the holidays, it's going to change again. So it gets a little more complicated. I think if you're going to have a take-home, though, something to think about, the 8th edition is now going to include patients with primary tumor extension into extrapulmonary structures. That's going to be T3 or T4 patients, or mediastinal lymph nodes. That's going to be N2 or N3 lymph nodes, but do not have distant metastases. So these patients are going to have pretty substantially advanced disease within the chest. It also is going to include tumors that are more than 5 centimeters in size who have hilar, intrapulmonary, or peribronchial lymph node status. That's the T3N1 group, or tumors above 7 centimeters, that's the T4 group, regardless of node status. So T4N0 is still going to be stage 3 disease. So it's kind of like everything that doesn't fit everywhere else tends to wind up in here. So it's really a challenge. So for the T3N1 group, surgery if resection is feasible, followed by chemotherapy. If surgery is not feasible, combination chemo-radiation therapy is certainly appropriate. Most other presentations, chemo-radiation in the frontline setting would be what we would consider in those patients. So we'll now move to the treatment of metastatic disease. In this particular situation, we've got a couple of things to consider. Are there immune markers that might be present? Is there a driver mutation that might be present? What are our goals of care and our goals for treatment? Because these patients are not going to be curable, but we might be in a situation where we can prolong the quality of the time that they have and control symptoms for considerable periods of time. I think we're all seeing these patients in this particular setting doing better because they're living longer. We have opportunities to get to know them better. What about immunotherapy? Well, for years, we really didn't think that bronchogenic carcinoma was all that immunogenic, but about 9 years ago, we got this phase 1 study of nivolumab going. It was subsequently published in 2005. And was nivolumab in previously treated non-small cell lung cancer patients. Now, nivolumab is a fully human PD-1 monoclonal antibody, and it helps block certain areas in the immune system that are known as checkpoints. So it inhibits these checkpoints. And the analogy that I like to use for patients is, imagine that you're watching a football game and the running back stiff arms a would-be tackler. That stiff arm is the checkpoint. It's what the cancer cells are doing to check the immune system. In this case, it's the would-be tackler, to avoid being detected and sequestered and subsequently destroyed. So if we can inhibit the cancer cells' ability to give that stiff arm, now we make it easier for the tackler to take down that running back. So that's what we're trying to accomplish here. So these were in patients who had received multiple lines of therapy previously. Typically, a person's response in a phase one trial, if you look at a group of patients that are on that, the response rate is 5% or less. The average duration of response is about 6 weeks. So this is a group of people who really have aggressive cancers, and they're very near the end of their life, and so they're just trying something in the hope of getting a sense about whether or not it's going to be effective. Well, an overall response rate of 18% is pretty extraordinary, but what's even more extraordinary is that this is a population of patients that typically will live about 4 months. This population of patients, the overall survival was nearly 10 months. 1 year survival was 42%. So this was a phase one trial that demonstrated not only a fairly reasonable response rate, but substantially prolonged survivability, a threefold increase in their survivability over no treatment. You just don't see that in a phase one trial. It just doesn't happen. And yet that's exactly what happened with nivolumab. So all of a sudden, everybody around the country sort of sat up and took notice. And it led to another trial that was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2012. This was a phase two study of nivolumab in refractory squamous cell carcinoma, 14.5% overall response rate. Not great. But durable responses were noted, again, lasting several months. And so when it works well, and it works for a fairly long period of time. Most patients were treated with conventional therapy who respond, again, have a response duration of just a few weeks. So pretty remarkable stuff. As a result of that, there were a series of studies that have gone forward. And they're all known as the CheckMate series, and there's a couple of other names out there, but the CheckMate trials have really taken off. And so taking a look at nivolumab versus chemotherapy in squamous cell carcinoma. The phase three study looked at that specifically, and the response rate here for nivolumab was just about twice what it was for docetaxel, Taxotere, in squamous non-small cell lung cancer. Response rate was good. Duration of response, again, was better than chemotherapy. We really didn't see that duplicated quite to the extent in non-squamous cell, non-small cell lung cancer over in CheckMate 057, but when those patients responded, durability was noted in their response rates as well. And the overall response rate for nivolumab in that study was 19%. Unfortunately, that particular study, it seemed like we had a lot of cross interference, and this study has been critiqued to some extent because it didn't appear that those patients did quite as well. So all the other studies that we have actually been very favorable. So we're still trying to feel our way through the non-squamous histology. These studies, and many like them, were really important to us, and as a result of that, on March 4, 2015, the Food and Drug Administration granted approval of nivolumab in treatment of patients with advanced squamous non-small cell lung cancer with progression on or after platinum-based chemotherapy. Pembrolizumab is another drug very similar to nivolumab, monoclonal antibody that, again, is a checkpoint inhibitor. At the level of PD-1, programmed death 1, PD-1, was published by Jaron et al. In the New England Journal of Medicine in 2015. This study broke people into two specific groups to look at dose intensity to see if there was a role. So 485 patients received pembrolizumab at a dose of either 2 milligrams per kilogram or 10 milligrams per kilogram every 3 weeks, or 10 milligrams per kilogram every 2 weeks, to kind of see if we could understand the dosing schedule and intensity a little bit better. So they were assigned either to a training group or to a validation group. group, and this was a first study to look at the possibility that maybe we should be selecting these patients because, you know, we've seen some response rates here that are very interesting, but it doesn't seem like we're seeing 40 and 50% response rates. We're seeing 18, 16% response rates, and yet when people respond, the overall length of that response is pretty favorable. So maybe there's something to this. Let's see if we can understand that. So they began to evaluate for PD-L1, which is essentially the ligand, the protein of PD-1, in those tumor samples to see if possibly there was something that we could bring out in that particular case as well. So that was a component of this study. The objective response rate in this study was 19.4%. Median duration of response was 12.5 months. The median duration of progression-free survival, 3.7 months, doesn't seem like it's too terribly exciting. The median duration of overall survival is 12 months, however, and normally for patients who have stage 4 lung cancer, the median duration of survival is somewhere on the order of about 9 months. They looked at a subtype analysis then at the specific group of people who expressed PD-L1, because if that's our target, there might be some potential role whether you express the PD-L1 or you don't express the PD-L1. Is there any sort of selectivity there? Well, in those patients who had at least 50% of tumor cells with PD-L1, it correlated with improved efficacy. In that response, in that group, the overall response rate was 45.2%. The median overall survival had not been reached at the time of the data analysis, which was 14 to 18 months into that study with some of those patients. And so what we saw in that particular case was overexpression of the protein and our ability to measure it was very important in terms of determining who was going to respond and who wasn't. Now, it seems like you'd want to do that these days because these medications are expensive. But really, until we had this data, we didn't have any concept that really looking at this was the right thing to do. So all of the patient populations that we had treated to that point were unselected for PD-L1. So we were just kind of working in the dark. If you've been doing oncology for a while or you've had oncology patients in your practice and you've been at this for a while, it kind of goes back to the days when we used to treat breast cancer by putting women on tamoxifen just because they had breast cancer. The concept of looking for estrogen and progesterone receptor studies really hadn't been developed because we didn't have any markers to do it. The response rate in that unselected patient population was something that was a little bit higher than placebo. Wow, that's really great. It works better than placebo. Yippee. When we started to identify estrogen and progesterone receptors on breast cancer cells, the response rate in the studies that were conducted subsequent to that went up into the 50 to 60% range. And it went up because now we were better able to select patients for therapy. So once again, Goldilocks comes back to see us, and we think that probably one of the things we want to do is to not utilize these medications on everybody, but we should be thoughtfully considering when appropriate and where we can, when we have the opportunity about evaluating for the presence of PD-L1 to ensure our PD-1 inhibitors are going to be effective. And there will also be inhibitors coming out in the near future that suppress that protein as well. We'll definitely want to be checking for those. These medications are rather expensive. So in terms of toxicities with those therapies, patients, kind of like chemotherapy, they're going to have fatigue, they're going to have rash, they're going to have pruritus, myalgias, loss of appetite. But because we're affecting the immune system, certain immune-related things can happen. You can get colitis, and this is an autoimmune colitis. It can be really, really bad. You can have thyroiditis, so the thyroid gets inflamed. You can have elevation of liver transaminases, so a transaminitis. And you can develop autoimmune disorders as well. Now, as somebody who trained in general internal medicine, I'm sort of used to monitoring for some of these minor problems as they pop up, and I feel relatively confident in my ability to manage. If somebody's thyroid is a little bit low, we can probably get them started on a little something, contacting the patient's primary care physician, making sure everybody stayed in the loop. But when the thyroid goes bad in a situation like this, or if I have some sort of thyroid inflammation, then I probably need to consider the possibility possibility that this person is going to have this for months, perhaps a year or more. And we really need to get our colleagues who are subspecialists who are involved with that really involved with the care of the patient at that point. Autoimmune colitis is really not something that I want to mess with. And so my GI colleagues are going to be in a better position to manage that than I would. And you're going to see all sorts of things. Guillain-Barré syndrome has been reported with these things. I had a patient in the hospital about 3 months ago who developed abrupt transverse myelitis. You thought the guy had basically transected his cord until you saw the MRI that showed no cord compression anywhere. And he had had clear evidence of transverse myelitis at a very discrete level. Had a level, had loss of sensation, two-point discrimination, flaccid paresis, the whole nine yards. And within 24 hours, we were able to reverse the process, and he walked out of the hospital 48 hours later. So, you know, you need to go talk to your oncologist about whether or not you should continue with this medication, because this is possibly going to happen in future treatments. So you really have to kind of think through this. We also can see this thing called pseudoprogression, because while it's wonderful that we're involving the immune system, those tumors can swell. And so you can see on a CT scan that it looks like it's getting worse, and it may take 6 to 10 weeks before that tumor really begins to shrink. Well, it's filling up with immune cells. And as a result, those immune cells are killing the cancer. So it looks like things are more progressive. So we've really had to learn not to stop treatment too quickly in patients who are beginning on therapy with these particular drugs. See, just kind of by way to kind of start wrapping this up, we also have epidermal growth factor receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitors. We've got three of those commercially available, erlotinib, gefitinib, and afatinib. These agents can be reasonably effective in certain patients who have this. And so afatinib provides irreversible EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor activity with specificity, very, very specific activity, and was approved for use by the FDA in July of 2013. There have been two large studies that compared afatinib to chemotherapy, and looking at the situation, we saw these studies go in and pool their analysis to really determine what the response is going to be. And here's an example. In the yellow is chemotherapy with an overall survival of 24 months, and here's the afatinib group with an overall survival of 27 months. So it's really the first study to demonstrate overall survival benefit for genotype-driven therapy versus chemotherapy in metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. So certainly worthy of a consideration. Again, we've got the anaplastic lymphoma kinase inhibitors as well, crizotinib and ceritinib. This kind of looks like the traffic system for DC traffic trying to get out of town on Friday afternoon, pretty busy place to be, but it gives you a sense of how involved this whole process really is. And so looking at crizotinib, this is data that's a little bit dated at this point. We've been using crizotinib for a while. We looked at first-line crizotinib versus pemetrexed cisplatin or pemetrexed carboplatin in patients with ALK-positive non-small cell lung cancer. This was 343 patients. And there was a subsequent crossover to the opposite arm after primary response data had been completed. So if one arm wasn't working, you were given the option of crossing over if you wanted. In that particular study, what we found was that those patients who were on chemotherapy had a progression-free survival time of 7 months versus 11 months for crizotinib. So you did well for about 40% longer in the crizotinib group. And the overall response, 45% for platinum-based chemotherapy, pretty good response rate in that group, to be honest, versus 74% with crizotinib. And so here's a single agent that's just kicking the teeth out of standard chemotherapy. So very, very positive study. Ceritinib, just to make it brief before I finish up here, ceritinib data very similar to what we saw with crizotinib. Ceritinib is technically about 20 times more potent than crizotinib, so we would typically think, well, if it's 20 times more potent, maybe it's 20 times more effective. I wish I could tell you that that was the case. It is a very active agent, but it certainly isn't 20 times more effective. It would be a lion in a pack of cubs if it were able to do that. But we still see some pretty favorable responses, and I think the thing that's really interesting, this was published just about 3 years ago. If you look at those patients who were who were naive with their treatment, the center island here, 69.5% of those patients had responses. Well, you'd never had one of these agents before, your tumor's ALK positive, you'd expect that sort of a response rate. But if you look at the people who had received prior therapy with an ALK inhibitor, so they'd received crizotinib before, 55% of those patients still responded to another ALK inhibitor. So we still got a successful second line ALK inhibitor in this particular case that over 50% of patients respond to. We just don't see that in oncology. If you have disease that's progressive on one drug, pretty much every drug in that group is going to be resistant. It's not going to be effective. And so to be able to see that in this particular setting is really reassuring to the oncologist because it means that we've got some additional tools. So if you're going to break it down, I would say you're going to divide it down to those patients who have one of three things. They're either going to have a driver mutation that's not present, in which case combination chemotherapy is where Goldilocks is going to like to live. Platinum doublets are going to dominate. Sometimes we'll utilize bevacizumab, Avastin. It's a VEGF inhibitor. Maintenance chemotherapy with a single agent is often utilized, pemetrexed in that case, on completion of combination treatment in those patients who have non-squamous histology. The second group that you would be in is that your driver mutation status is unknown. It didn't get done, or it got lost, or somehow the quantity wasn't sufficient. Combination chemotherapy for metastatic disease, as long as the status is unknown, but if data becomes available, the results are incorporated into the treatment when it's feasible to do so. So we will take that information and use it when it's appropriate. The third group that you're going to be in is when a driver mutation is present. In that situation, if it's an EGFR mutation, you got an EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor that you can consider in the front line of treatment for metastatic disease. We know that it improves progression-free survival compared to chemotherapy. It's just a better fit for many patients. If they are ALK fusion gene positive, then we're going to want to treat them with an ALK inhibitor. So crizotinib or ceritinib, higher response rates again compared to chemotherapy. So what's really amazing is that if you've got one of those mutation statuses, as it currently stands in 2017, you actually don't get cytotoxic chemotherapy in the front line in many cases. Sometimes you do because you just don't have the mutation, but if you've got a mutation, we can actually use targeted therapies in the front line. So we're beginning to see that standard cytotoxic chemotherapy is being relegated to a second line or even third line status in those particular patient populations. So we've seen new treatments come out. We've also identified newer strategies, but I think one of the strategies that we all ought to take home with us is the concept of utilizing a palliative care team in the management of these patients. And probably the lead person in this has been a lady by the name of Dr. Jennifer Temmel, who has been at Mass General in Boston for some time. She actually did this during her fellowship, and she had to admit when she was a fellow, if you would listen to her speak, she said, you know, I really wasn't convinced about the role of a palliative care team. I was doing my Hem-Onc fellowship, really wasn't convinced at that particular point. But I decided, you know, it's either going to work or it's not going to work. So what they did was they took a small group, divided it in two, and it was chemotherapy as appropriate for non-small cell lung cancer. All these patients had stage four disease. They were all being treated with palliative intent. And one of the groups wound up on a palliative care team that provided additional support, additional encouragement, symptom management, treatment control, and that sort of thing. And in the people who received the palliative care treatment, their survivability was about 35% longer than it was in the non-palliative care treatment group. Again, these people are getting the same chemotherapy, so it's essentially a wash in that regard. Their quality of life was substantially better if they were on the palliative care team. And so if you want your patients to live longer, it seems reasonable to consider including a palliative care team, not just for the quality and comfort of the patient, but in order to help them live longer and with higher quality in the days that they have left. So it seems to be very, very reasonable to consider those sorts of things. So we've talked about the major risk factors for the development of lung cancer. We talked about smoking. We talked about pulmonary fibrosis. We talked about alcohol use and several other things. We also described the role of driver mutation status in determining treatment options. And we talked about how 50% of those patients on average had an actionable mutation. They were used in the setting of metastatic disease, and it may be combined with other modalities in the near future. We also talked about general treatment options for patients with early stage and metastatic lung cancers. So the goal of treatment for early stage disease is cure, and the goal of treatment in advanced disease is disease-free survival. The goal of treatment in metastatic disease is palliative, comfort and quality. Now, I would say that with respect to non-small cell lung cancer, we're seeing things change very, very, very quickly. And so I think if I were to come back in a year or two and give the same presentation, it would likely look very different than what we've talked about even today, and hopefully with even better response. So the take-home message, the message that I would give Goldilocks is I do think we have places where we can have not too much, not too little, not enough of this, not too much of that. But most importantly, we want to stay tuned because we're getting better at what we do, and we are offering these people additional hope.